From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
President Trump does a 180 on drug addiction. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. The President's Special Commission on Opioid Abuse has recommended he declare a national emergency. Tuesday, he sent word he would not. But the number of overdose deaths in a year exceeds troop casualties in the entire Vietnam War. Yesterday, he said yes, after all. A national emergency could mean federal resources for treatment, including for mental illness. It's a long way from Nancy Reagan's Just Say No. But she was talking about crack cocaine in the inner cities, while opioids are a scourge of white Americans in Republican enclaves. We'll hear more. Also today, the president tells North Korea the U.S. military is locked and loaded. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The FDA says it's uncertain about the safety of the Impossible Burger. That's the meatless patty that seems to bleed. Are the regulators behind the curve when it comes to food technology? That's our talking point later on in our program. Our main topic today, the president has reversed course on declaring opiate addiction a national emergency. Or has he? First, this news update. The Associated Press reports there is a back-channel diplomacy between the U.S. and North Korea, but it's done nothing so far to stop the escalating war of words. Yesterday, President Trump said, "We'll always consider negotiations," but today he tweeted this: "Military solutions are now fully in place, locked and loaded, should North Korea act unwisely." Aaron David Miller is Vice President and Distinguished Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Always good to have you on our program.
Always great to be here, Warren.
You have said, others have as well, that this war of words could turn into a real war. What do you think is the most likely scenario?
You know, two days ago, I would have argued to you that this was like the Seinfeld episode, a show about nothing. That Kim has made these threats before. He's threatened Guam before. Over the years, American presidents' rhetoric has also been much, much tougher. But I think there are new ingredients here. First is the intemperate words by the president in response to a set of declarations both by Kim and lower-level officials, particularly in relationship to the possibility of actually launching four intermediate-range missiles toward Guam. And second is the president's continued rhetoric, which has gotten much tougher, particularly the use of terms like locked and loaded. And you now have statements from American military commanders on Guam with respect to their state of readiness with B-52s and B-1B bombers. So I think that the danger level, as far as I can detect, has increased. You've got escalatory words, and you've got the more strategic problem of what to do about further tests, either ballistic missile tests or nuclear tests, or in coming days, will Kim actually use those intermediate-range missiles, even without warheads? And the assumption would, by an American military commander, would have to be that they have warheads on them. Will the president respond? So I think you've gotten to a situation where Kim is in a box, Trump has put himself in a box, and there's a very real danger here of some sort of confrontation.
What about this so-called New York connection and back-channel negotiations?
I mean, those talks among America's most senior official in charge of North Korea and a member of the North Korean delegation have been ongoing. I don't think the New York channel is active right now, and it's designed not to deal with matters of strategy and high politics. It's designed to deal with issues relating to human rights, particularly Americans who have found themselves in North Korean jails. I think you'd need a much higher channel, much higher level in order to defuse this crisis. Whether it might have to be discreet, but I think it's going to be have to be much higher level. You remember in '94, Jimmy Carter injected himself into the situation, and as a consequence, you had an agreed framework which lasted a while. And others, including William Perry and Madeleine Albright, have also traveled to Pyongyang. So I think you need a much higher level emissary in order to defuse this.
You have said that the United States is going to simply have to recognize a very unpleasant reality. What do you mean?
I mean, look, I don't live in a galaxy far, far away, and I don't believe in transformations. I live on planet Earth, and what I see with my own eyes. That Kim has decided, and it's now a formal part of the North Korean Constitution, that he needs nuclear weapons largely as a defensive deterrent. If in fact reports are true that he has 60 by 2020, he'll have half the nuclear arsenal that the Brits have. He is not going to give up those nukes anytime soon. I'll say it again: he is not going to give up those nukes anytime soon. So the notion that somehow the negotiations will somehow magically or fantastically lead to some sort of fundamental rollback of his nuclear stockpile, let alone denuclearization, I think is frankly an illusion. The second illusion is that the Chinese somehow, that we can contract this out to them. They are not a disinterested player in all of this. They use North Korea as a hedge against the United States and growing influence of a U.S.-backed South Korea to reunification of the peninsula, which they do not want. And finally, last point, I would argue to you, Warren, that the only power in the world that has the capacity to defuse this and to give Kim what he wants is the United States. The Chinese can't give him security guarantees. The Chinese cannot, in a de facto sense, recognize North Korea as a nuclear power. And the Chinese aren't able to offer the sorts of guarantees that, if in fact Kim is even interested in this and becoming a kind of a modified China model to develop his country economically, but still maintain a nuclear deterrent. Only the United States can do that. And I think in the end, if we get out of this crisis, and I suspect we will, I'm hoping we will, we'll have to deal with that long-term strategic problem.
Aaron David Miller at the Woodrow Wilson Center, as always, thanks for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
In a moment, President Trump does a 180 on drug addiction. Or does he? On To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. With approximately 142 Americans dying every day, America is enduring a death toll equal to September 11th every 3 weeks. That's according to the President's Special Commission on Opioid Abuse, chaired by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. It recommends that the President declare a national emergency. But on Tuesday, President Trump sent this word through Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price.
We believe that at this point that the resources that we need or the focus that we need to bring to bear to the opioid crisis at this point can be addressed without the declaration of an emergency, although all things are on the table for the president.
That was Tom Price on Tuesday. Then yesterday, the president said this to reporters.
The opioid crisis is an emergency, and I'm saying officially right now, it is an emergency. It's a national emergency. We're going to spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of money on the opioid crisis.
Keith Humphreys is a professor of psychiatry at Stanford. He was drug policy advisor in both the Bush and Obama administrations. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Good to talk to you again, Warren.
What do you make of the fact that the president sent word once again through Tom Price, no, we didn't need to have a national emergency. Now he says we do.
Yeah, I mean, it's, another case of confused policymaking out of the White House where it's not really clear what the goal is. It's clear what a national emergency means. It means that states that are currently suffering could have access to the fund that we normally use to respond when there's a hurricane or a flood or an earthquake. And that'd be a good thing. But in terms of what has actually been is going to be done, I can't really tell. I mean, what I do know is that all year the president has been trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which provides 2 million people with addiction health insurance. His own budget submitted to Congress proposes deep cuts in treatment for people who are addicted to opioids. So it's really it's very hard to read what is going on. I mean, at least the words sound like there might be a public health response, but the actions go in the other direction.
What would the states be able to do with that federal money that they're not doing now?
The states, when there's an emergency, states submit plans. The federal government decides which ones are, in fact, the disaster zones. And then governors write up, you know, here's how we want to spend the money. This is an unusual situation. Normally, it's a bit clear how you would spend it, like when there's a flood or a fire or whatever, as opposed to a long-term public health crisis. So people in the public health community are hoping how it will be spent will be on more treatment, more naloxone, which is the opioid overdose rescue drug, more education for doctors to prescribe better. But there's no guarantee of that. It could be spent on more law enforcement strike teams who are going to arrest more people. It could be spent on expanding, incarceration. We don't really know what the administration's goal is in doing this.
In that context, let me run another soundbite from what the president said yesterday.
We're also working with law enforcement officers to protect innocent citizens from drug dealers that poison our community. Strong law enforcement is absolutely vital to having a drug-free society.
William Kelly is professor of sociology at the University of Texas at Austin. He's author of From Retribution to Public Safety, Disruptive Innovation of the American Criminal Justice System. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. My pleasure.
What does the president, what we just heard from the president, mean to you?
It means the same old playbook that we've been working from for the past 50 years, trying to arrest, convict, and then punish substance use disorders out of individuals. I fear that Trump is lumping together drug dealers and those who are caught in possession of drugs. Those are very different sets of individuals. A law enforcement or criminal justice response might be reasonable for those who are engaged in drug distribution, but in terms of a primary focus on trying to reduce demand for those substances, it needs to focus on people who are using. And law enforcement and the criminal justice system have failed, and we know why they failed, to reduce demand. The problem is that punishment does nothing to address addiction or dependence or abusive drugs.
What about the president saying, as he also has, echoing Nancy Reagan, it would seem, that the main thing is to get people not to use these drugs in the first place?
Well, I think that once again underscores his fundamental misunderstanding of how drug abuse, dependence, and addiction evolve. I mean, for many of the individuals that we're talking about in terms of this current crisis, which I would be clear to say that this is not just this is the tip of the iceberg of a much larger drug problem in this country. But it fails to appreciate that many of the individuals who get addicted to opioids begin with prescription medication that's prescribed by physicians for legitimate reasons. And I don't think Trump is a physician. I don't think Trump is a lot of things, but I don't think he has the understanding of how somebody can get in a situation of abusing or become dependent or addicted on drugs.
Keith Humphreys, you're a professor of psychiatry. Tell us a little bit more about how this process occurs.
Well, I think Dr. Kelly said it really well, and this is why I just say no message would not matter. About 80% of people who are using heroin started on prescription drugs, and in many cases, those were people who followed their instructions exactly from your doctor. I mean, if you have you hurt your back on the job, and the doctor says, here's your Vicodin, take it, four times a day for the next month, you're not going to just say no. I mean, you go to the healthcare system for advice on how to get better. So people who complied with that ended up dependent on it because we prescribe way more opioids than we should, six times what any other developed country prescribes. And then that dependency sets in, and eventually they move over to heroin. That's how it's happening, not due to some kind of, an idea in the country that drugs are in no way dangerous and one should always say no. That's just not where it came from. And those types of prevention programs, by the way, those kind of DARE things for kids have been evaluated for years, and they just do not work.
William Kelly, back to you again at the University of Texas at Austin. What is the reason, do you think, that these things happen or this scenario happens here in the United States and not in other countries? Does it have something to do with the practice of medicine?
It has a lot to do with, I would say it has more to do with public health than necessarily the practice of medicine. One of the reasons that we have, you know, roughly 80% of people in the criminal justice system, the reason that, roughly 80% have a substance use disorder is because there's a lack of treatment in the community for them to seek out to try and address the problem. The criminal justice system has become, over the past 50 years, a dumping ground for individuals that we don't know what else to do with, or we don't have the resources in place to deal with. As Professor Humphreys was saying earlier, I mean, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act is these decisions don't occur in silos. There will be cascade effects on in terms of criminal justice, because that will further restrict access of individuals to mental health treatment and substance use treatment. So I think, to answer your question, it has a lot to do with how we think about public health in this country, how we fund or don't fund public health at the national level, the state level, and at the local level. I live in Texas. This is a state that decided, for whatever reasons, not to expand Medicaid. That has profound consequences, not just for public health, but for other institutions like criminal justice.
When Nancy Reagan said, just say no, she would appear to me to have been suggesting that people have a control over this. What does mental illness have to do with it? How important is it in addiction?
Well, we know from a good bit of research that there's a high comorbidity or co-occurrence of mental illness and substance use disorders. That adds a whole other layer of complexity to treatment that I'm sure Professor Humphreys knows much more about than I do. But what it underscores for me is another reason why the criminal justice system is not the place for many of these folks to be, because it's a system that is ill-equipped to not only deal with substance use disorders or not only deal with mental illness, but when you combine the two, that dramatically ramps up the complexity of the situation. We are simply perpetuating the recidivism, which is, for substance use disorder offenders, is around 80%. The reoffending of individuals with substance use disorders is about 80%. It's the classic revolving door. We're getting nowhere by simply thinking we can lock people up and that's going to change something. It doesn't.
Keith Humphreys, how does treatment work with people who are both addicted and mentally ill?
It's always more complicated when a person has a comorbid mental illness. They have a harder time engaging in treatment. They often have plenty of other challenges in their lives around difficulty getting employment. They're often socially isolated, have difficulty with housing, and so on. Nonetheless, treatment can still be highly effective. I mean, one of the only good things you can say about the opioid epidemic is, at least relative to some other drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine and so on, for which we do not have good medications, we have multiple really effective medications for opioid addiction. So there is hope, you know, for everybody who has this problem to get well.
So it appears we have two models then. We have the treatment model, we have the law enforcement and punishment model. Adrienne Andrews is a chief diversity officer at Weber State University in Utah. She recently wrote an article in Utah's Standard Examiner. It was titled, "How Does the War on Drugs Differ from America's Opioid Crisis?" Good to have you on our program.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you for having me, Warren.
What is the answer to that question?
The answer for me is actually pretty straightforward. It's that we stop looking at these things through different lenses and we recognize addiction is addiction. It doesn't matter if it's from crack cocaine. It doesn't matter if it's from heroin or opioid use that leads to heroin abuse. It means that we educate and rehabilitate, period.
Educate and rehabilitate, as opposed to what?
As opposed to incarcerate, which is exactly what Attorney General Sessions is talking about again in terms of kind of reigniting this law enforcement push toward incarceration of drug users. And as my co-speakers today on the panel have indicated, that doesn't change anything. It just restarts the cycle. So how do we break that cycle? One, by recognizing that drug use and abuse is happening everywhere. The difference between the war on drugs was people believed it was a good versus a bad situation. It was us versus them, and them were the people using drugs in the inner cities, and they were not like us. Now it's a crisis because the opioid user is our mom, it's our sister, it's our neighbor, maybe it's even us. And so it went from looking at people who were other than us to looking at people like us, and we want to help people like us. And now we need to recognize the lenses we help all people who are drug abusers.
So when you say we're looking at it or have looked at it through different lenses, you're talking about the difference between whose addiction you're talking about.
That's absolutely correct. In fact, if you look at the CDC and you look at the prescription rates for users of opioids, what you'll find is their typical user was a white female who started using because of an accident or injury. What we weren't seeing was minority users, in part because there may have been some bias in prescriptions by doctors who didn't really give those prescriptions of opioids to patients of color. So we didn't really see an increase there. So when we're talking about an opioid addiction, we're really talking about an addiction facing middle-class white people, which is really important and significant, but not more significant or more important than any other segment of our population.
And what percentage of those who are incarcerated for drug addictions, and how many of them or what percentage of them are minorities?
I don't have that data. But my good friend on the panel, Dr. Kelly May, what I can say is the statistics bear out that there are greater percentages of the minority populations that are incarcerated than exist in the general population of the country.
Professor Kelly, is that right?
Yes, it is. About 25% of new admissions to state prison systems are drug offenders. It's not so easy to separate out, you know, who are addicts versus those, you know, caught in possession versus those dealing. But we do know that large numbers of those in prisons today are simply folks who got caught in possession of a felony amount of drugs that they were using themselves, and it gets them into the justice system. Large segment of it is minority or poor, and obviously those two things correlate. So it's a problem of disadvantage, and those who suffer the most from that are those who are most disadvantaged.
Let me go back to the question of medical practice. We just heard from Adrienne Andrews that the addiction to opioids seems to start with white females and not with blacks or Latinos. Is that true, that they are minority people are less likely to get those kind of prescriptions than white Americans?
Sorry, who is that for?
I'm asking you. Well, William Kelly.
Oh, why is it such a racial difference?
Yeah, doesn't it have to do with the practice of medicine in different parts of the community?
I think it does. I think it has to do with access to physicians who would prescribe painkillers for individuals who have, as she was describing, accidents in the workplace, who then require medication. There are also, there are other issues in play here, and I think some of the crackdown on prescribing painkillers has caused individuals to shift to a cheaper, more available heroin, and I think that's much of the reason why that policy of cracking down has consequences that perhaps were not intended, but have devastating consequences.
Keith Humphreys, back to you. We need to go to a break very soon, but can you quickly tell us what areas of the country are disaster zones in the context of this national emergency that the Special Commission has called for?
Well, originally, this started in rural areas, places like where I'm from, Appalachia. So West Virginia, for example, is the highest death rate in the country. But the 2015 data, national survey data, shows that it's now just about everywhere, that people in the suburbs, people in the cities are as likely to be prescribed opioids and to misuse opioids as in rural areas. The only reason the death rates are higher in rural areas is probably just because the healthcare systems are weaker, the hospitals are farther away, and that sort of thing. But this is now a national problem.
We're going to be back in a moment. We'll talk about the situation in New Hampshire. On our talking point later, the meatless Impossible Burger and the FDA are regulators behind the curve when it comes to food technology. This is To the Point from PRI. We're only back with To the Point to talk about calls for a national emergency declaration on the opioid crisis and how it differs from what we've referred to in the past as the war on drugs. James Buffetti is with us. He's senior assistant to New Hampshire's attorney general. He is the chief of the Consumer Protection and Antitrust Bureau. Good to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Warren, for inviting me.
Your state has initiated a lawsuit against one of the major pharmaceutical companies. What's that about?
Well, for the last couple of years, we've been investigating the marketing practices of the major opioid companies. We focused on Purdue Pharma, which is the maker of OxyContin. And on Tuesday, we filed a 100-page complaint, a civil enforcement complaint, alleging violations of our Consumer Protection Act and other statutes for their marketing practices of their opioids in New Hampshire.
You're saying that they were intentionally misleading?
Well, we're saying that that as they marketed these drugs aggressively in New Hampshire, that they falsely denied or trivialized the risk of addiction. They overstated the benefits of opioids, and they told people that things were not true.
Tell us about New Hampshire in general and the extent to which this opioid crisis has rocked that state.
Well, in 2016, the deputy administrator of the DEA called New Hampshire ground zero of the opioid epidemic. In 2015, there were 438 fatal overdoses. That number was higher in 2016. It's on track to be around the same this year. That's a lot for New Hampshire, and so it's really rocked this state. It's affected every city and town. It's a tremendous drain on emergency resources, and it's had profound effect on this state.
Is this something that people see publicly?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's every day in the headlines. I mean, last week there was a story of a father who went into a convenience store, or I guess it was a fast food restaurant, with his son, a young son. The father went into a restroom and he overdosed. The son was left in the restaurant. He went to get help. They came and they had to administer a couple of doses of naloxone to bring him back. So this happens fairly frequently and impacts people. People see it. The police in Manchester, New Hampshire, have to go and check the public parks and fields to get the hypodermic needles cleaned up so that things don't happen. A young child found a hypodermic needle recently on Hampton Beach. So it's affecting everybody's lives. They see it. They know it's real. It's the number one issue, I would say, in New Hampshire right now.
What are you asking from Purdue Pharma?
Well, we're asking that they stop their deceptive and unfair marketing, that they abate the public nuisance that they've created, that they basically pay to fix what they broke.
How do they abate the public nuisance? What do they do?
Well, it probably means that you pay money to reimburse communities for the cost, for the social cost of this. The price of naloxone has gone up tremendously. You know, a few years ago, it was around $15 a dosage. I think now people are paying something like $75. Every first responder has it. It's in schools. It's a tremendous cost. It's a drain on those resources. There are other social costs. Treatment resources have to be ramped up. That's being paid for by the state in some cases. And so they should have to be accountable for causing this type of nuisance and to somehow pay to fix it.
William Kelly, back to you on this issue. Is this the right way to go?
Well, you know, I think it's a part of a much bigger picture. I think to make it real simple, we can either address supply control, we can address demand control, or we can address both. And I think going forward, I wouldn't even use the word war on drugs. That has too many implications. I would say our efforts have to include some criminal justice, some law enforcement, some focus on supply control. But don't put all of our eggs in that basket, because that has been a failed enterprise for the past 50 years. The end game, in my mind, is to focus on reducing demand. There is so much money to be made in the drug industry here. I don't mean pharmaceutical. I mean in the illicit drug industry, that, you know, trying to control what comes across the borders, trying to control what is distributed across cities and within cities, is largely futile. I'm not saying we should abandon it, but I think we should devote many, many more resources to trying to treat individuals to reduce demand for using these drugs.
Adrian Andrews, back to you. In the first part of our program, you compared what's happening now to what was referred to as the war on drugs in the Reagan years and after that. Tell us how differently this issue is being talked about now that it involves, as you indicated, white people in places like New Hampshire, as opposed to the way it was talked about when it was a problem largely the inner cities.
Well, I would say that the main change in the presentation of this issue is it went from them to us, and it's all of our responsibility. Where we know the war on drugs really had significant critical impacts on communities of color and those with limited economic interests. As we look on the crisis today, what we're saying is that everyone is responsible for it. Where even Goldman Sachs is saying there are economic repercussions from the opioid crisis in terms of employment and debt. And so we have to be cognizant of the fact that we can't look at this through a singular lens, and we can't just say it's an opioid addiction. The country has an addiction problem.
James,
opioids are a critical piece of that, but that's not the only addiction problem that we've got. And when we are only focusing on opioids and only focusing on the prescription aspect of it, that's problematic. I would agree with my friends on the panel that we've got to look at this with multiple or intersecting pieces all working at the same time. We can't just look at the legal aspect in terms of criminal enforcement. We have to look at the addressing the actual need for the drug, the desire for the drug. We have to be able to work across efforts and make sure we're all on the same page. And that's going to take the states and the local governments and communities working with the federal government, not just to make sure the money is spent correctly, but to make sure that we are actually benefiting all of the members of our society.
James Buffetti, back to you in the New Hampshire Attorney General's office, or again, Chief of Consumer Protection and the Antitrust Bureau. You're suing the Purdue Pharma Company, and yet the Attorney General's office also, of course, is in charge of law enforcement. How do you achieve a balance?
Well, you know, I think as others have said, this is a multifaceted problem, and you need to attack it from various ways. So we've done a lot of work in terms of prescribing guidelines, working with the licensing boards, like the boards of the Board of Medicine. We've looked at our criminal laws, and there are statutes involving death-resulting cases where someone is selling drugs that cause the death and seeing if there's some criminal liability in those cases. We've beefed up the prescription drug monitoring program here, and the state has worked on trying to improve its treatment options. So there's a lot of things you have to look at, and of course the work that we're doing, which is it's one aspect, but you know, Purdue and these other drug companies, they created a market for chronic pain users that wasn't there before, and they did that by misperceptions and telling people that things that simply were not true about how addictive these drugs were for chronic pain patients for long term use. They need to go back and to change the culture and fix those misperceptions that they created.
We hear about overprescription, largely perhaps, or due in part, I guess, to response to advertising and that sort of thing. Are pharmaceuticals such as OxyContin sold on the black market? Is that something that people can buy? And how long does it take them to have to go from there to heroin, which is so much cheaper?
Is that question to me?
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure you can get these drugs on the black market. I don't think that's the problem. The bigger problem is that these people are getting them through their doctors. 4 out of 5 heroin users start with prescription pain medications. They're being overprescribed, and so we need to look differently at how we treat pain, how many pills we prescribe at a time, how we reevaluate these patients once they have a short-term prescription to see if there's any risks of addiction. Those are the kinds of things that will make a difference.
Keith Humphreys, back to you, our first guest. You were a drug policy advisor in the Bush and Obama administrations. What about enforcement on a federal level, not just against the drug companies, but what about the doctors and the fact that they apparently are over-prescribing? Is there some way to prevent them from doing that? Is the AMA or other medical associations getting involved in this?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, there's definitely been a complete change at the AMA of, emphasis on pain as the fifth vital sign and that everybody needs opioids. They've been officially backing off of that. I mean, the federal government, the states regulate medicine in our country.
Mm-hmm.
That's who runs it. So they're going to be the leaders on that. The place where federal agents are useful is a very, very small number of doctors, less than 1%, who are just behaving in absolutely criminal ways. So when I was in the White House, something like 98 of the top 100 OxyContin prescribers were all in South Florida. And, you know, it's just not that painful to live in South Florida. You know, it couldn't possibly be medical. And, you know, those places were basically spreading an opioid epidemic all throughout the Southeast. You know, cash only, prescription on site, no ID needed. And, you know, that's, you don't send a doctor into that situation. That's where you need a DEA agent to go in and close those places down, which they did. That's a really good use of enforcement. The federal government needs to do that. The federal government also needs to cooperate with other countries. So, you know, all these fentanyls are coming from China. And cooperation between, you know, us and China on that could help with that problem. Good foreign policy could help with that problem, although that does take longer than 140 characters.
Fentanyl, as I understand it, is mixed with heroin. What is fentanyl? What does it do?
So fentanyl is an opioid, a very potent opioid. It's actually a whole class of opioids. There's a bunch of different kinds of fentanyls. But you are right, it is far, far cheaper than heroin. So from the trafficking point of view, it's sensible to mix that in, really extend the product, and then sell it. But it's so lethal. I mean, that, you know, carfentanil, you know, is used to tranquilize elephants, just to give you an example of the strength of these medications. They dwarf that of heroin. They dwarf that of OxyContin. And so when that is in the heroin supply, you have a number of users who are just taking a dose that exceeds anything they're able to handle. And what happens then, you have a very rapid drop in respiration, the body's deprived of oxygen, and you get brain damage, heart damage, and sometimes death.
William Kelly, now at the University of Texas at Austin, you've focused on the switch from law enforcement to a treatment modality, and yet there has to be a balance. Let me ask you the same question I asked to James Boffetti. How do you make the balance between law enforcement and the treatment model?
Well, I couldn't agree more. There does need to be a balance. There is there's no magic bullet here. I think that balance is, you know, begins at the state house and at the level of Congress. But at the end of the day, these problems that we're talking about are local, and I really believe the solutions are local as well. What legislatures can do is to free up resources for local jurisdictions to provide more community-based treatment resources, so that individuals, you know, prior to getting involved in the criminal justice system, can go seek treatment. For individuals who do get involved in the criminal justice system, they can be diverted from criminal prosecution. Again, not all of them, but those who have a reasonable, you know, a public safety portfolio or risk can be placed into community-based diversion programs. What we know is essentially any contact with the criminal justice system is what is called criminogenic. That is, it heightens the risk of somebody reoffending. We need to try and avoid that because we're in that cycle of these individuals rotating in and out of the justice system nearly endlessly for years and years and years. So I think a lot of it is shifting resources, but importantly, and this really gets back to the original point about Trump, we need to change how we think about drugs, we need to change how we think about crime and punishment, and we need to raise the white flag and say the war on drugs has been a failure, and we need to recalibrate.
Adrian Angers, very quickly, because we're really out of time, what can be learned, do you think, now that this has become recognized as a national program, national problem, what can be learned from the old war on drugs?
What can be learned is we have to work together, and that means our medical folks with our law enforcement, with our city leaders, with our community. It means that we have to do education at all levels, starting out with what is wrong with drug use in the first place and understanding why people use drugs and continue to seek drugs in order to resolve and treat those who become addicted.
All right. We will see whether, in fact, the president does declare a national emergency, and if so, what that might mean. The devil is so often in the details, as we have heard once again today. Adrian Angers, again, Chief Diversity Officer at Weber State University. Thank you very much. James Boffetti with the New Hampshire Attorney General's Office. William Kelly at the University of Texas. His book, From Retribution to Public Safety, Disruptive Innovation of American Criminal Justice. And Keith Humphreys, Professor of Psychiatry at Stanford, Drug Policy Advisor in both the Bush and Obama administrations. Great to have you all on a very, very instructive program. Thanks so much. In a moment, the Impossible Burger and the FDA on To the Point from Public Radio International.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Renana here with today's talking point. The meatless Impossible Burger is being served at some of America's finest restaurants. It includes a special ingredient that makes it taste like meat and even appear to bleed like a real burger. But the FDA says it's not sure the Impossible Burger is safe. Evan Kleiman is the host of KCRW's program Good Food. Thanks so much for coming down the hall and talking to us.
Thank you, Warren.
What is the Impossible Burger? And I think a lot of our listeners may not go to America's finest restaurants.
The Impossible Burger is the latest attempt to create a non-meat burger, but with the mouthfeel and the visual cues of meat along with the taste. There have been many companies working on this, but so far, the Impossible Burger people seem to be the people that are coming the closest.
Okay. Tell us a little bit more about the mouthfeel and the visual clues, or cues, excuse me.
Well, when you get the burger served to you, and I had this experience in preparation for a segment we did on it for Good Food, it comes, it's usually served, in L.A. it seems to be being served like a In-N-Out burger, so it has all those visual cues. And then you look at the patty itself, and it looks, I would say, 90% like a ground beef burger. And that is a whole set of scientific creation on its own. But then what people are focusing with the FDA is this thing called heme, which is soy leg hemoglobin. And what it does is it gives the plant-based material a meatiness than meat has. And in addition, it has this ability to bleed. Well, you know, it has this sort of reddish juiciness. Okay. That is through the burger if it's not cooked too much. And it also has, heme gives it that metallic taste that we associate with blood. And so that also adds to the overall meatiness of the burger.
Just to reemphasize what you're saying, let me play an exchange from that program that you talked about between two UCLA professors of food science, Amy Rowat and Jenny Jay. Amy Rowat comes first.
The protein engineered for the Impossible Burger is like hemoglobin that's produced by yeast. And this is important for nitrogen fixation because having oxygen around inhibits the efficiency of the nitrogen fixation process, which is important for the plant. So having this heme, which has a really high affinity for oxygen in the like hemoglobin, makes it better for the plant. And it also imparts this color and also slightly metallic flavor to the Impossible Burger.
For me, it's been a while since I've had a beef burger, but it fits my memory exactly. I think it is right on.
How long has it been?
Well, 25 years.
So much for the science. Back to Evan Kleiman. What about the FDA, and how is it that the FDA can say that it's not sure this is safe when people all over the place apparently are eating it and it comes from soy?
Well, this is the part of the story that I find most intriguing, is I think most people imagine that food products go through this extensive approval process by the FDA or the USDA, by the government. And in fact, that isn't true. And what happened with the Impossible Burger is they voluntarily submitted it to the FDA for approval because they knew that there might be some issues with this engineered yeast, this heme. And the FDA came back and said, well, we're not sure. And which is just fascinating on so many different levels. I mean, given the state of the current administration's look at regulation and compliance in concert with budgetary issues, one is wondering who at the FDA are making these decisions now, and are they doing it across the board, or are they just looking at something that has a very high profile right now?
But if the FDA just said it wasn't sure, can it pass a regulation saying don't eat this stuff that has heme in it?
No.
No?
I don't believe so. I mean, it would have to be something very specific targeted to this, given that it's a voluntary compliance issue.
Now, it's my understanding there have not been a lot of tests of this. The FDA says that because the heme is derived from the soybean plant, which is not something that people usually eat, they eat it in different forms, it could be something that causes allergies.
Well, the Impossible Burger people came back with a big press release yesterday, and they basically say that there has been a lot of work done on soy leg hemoglobin. Even back into 2014, food safety and allergy experts at many different universities found that it is GRAS, which means generally recognized as safe, which is what the government uses to determine whether or not a food can be eaten or not.
On the one hand, people feel, as you indicated at the outset, that the FDA checks everything, makes sure it's safe. On the other hand, you're saying that its standard is so vague, it's generally recognized as safe?
Yes. Yes. In fact,
you don't test in the lab for that.
No, they don't test it in the lab for that. I mean, I think in this country, we rely a lot on self-testing. And they've done, the Impossible Burger did what they call stringent rat studies, feeding animals orders of magnitude more heme than a regular eater would ever experience with no adverse effect. We should also say that heme isn't the only ingredient in the burger. It's made out of wheat, potatoes, coconut oil. It's just this addition of this very particular engineered yeast that makes it different. Also, I think it's really interesting that how Impossible Burger chose to release this product in a very certain strata of restaurants with sort of celebrity vegans, you might say.
Yeah.
It's a group of people that kind of self-police, if you might say, around allergens. They're people that seem to be extremely concerned about what they eat and what kind of effect it has on their bodies. So if Impossible Burger were looking for a group that would report higher than any other, they certainly have found it.
And these are people who are well-to-do, who have access to politicians and the press, and who might sound off if they were all getting sick because of heme.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I ate a burger.
Okay.
And, you know, I it's like I would say 80% of an experience of eating a hamburger. And the whole thing is really fascinating. The company is a very interesting company because more and more I think there's pressure on food companies to address the impact that agriculture has on the planet. And I think that this product is geared more for people who want to attenuate their impact on the planet rather than people who are looking to become 100% vegans.
What about the FDA? Is it behind the curve on food technology?
Oh, I would definitely say yes. Because when you have a company like this that's raising such huge amounts of money, its latest round of venture capital, I think, was $75 million that just closed. You're looking at laboratories that can produce and investigate at such a higher level than government can do.
Bill Gates, one of the investors, apparently, in this particular company. But we're talking about an entire industry making meatless products for those people that you say that are very serious vegetarians, but that appear more and more like flesh so that more people will be attracted. Tell us more about that. Is it a big industry? Is it moving fast? Is it the kind of industry that's liable to see a bubble?
I don't think it'll see a bubble because as long as people perceive that there are ecological threats to the planet, there will be people who are looking elsewhere than livestock to fill part of their nutritional needs. There are many other companies. Most of them have not concentrated on this mouthfeel, this meatiness to the extent that Impossible Burger has. They're concentrating more on mouthfeel. Companies like Beyond Meat, who does chicken strips. And most of these foods are made out of legumes. And it's just, I mean, I think more and more as more people are looking to become ecologically savvy and want to change their behavior, well, it's a huge market of people. I doubt that there's going to be a bubble.
What does it cost to get an Impossible Burger? You said you had one, and they are only being sold, apparently, at very expensive restaurants. I take it it's more than an In-N-Out Burger.
Oh, yeah. But then one wonders, maybe the In-N-Out Burger is priced a bit too low. I don't really remember offhand how much the burger that I had at Crossroads was. I'd say it was probably a $14 burger.
Okay.
But it's also being served at Umami Burger, which is a much more of a burger joint.
All right. Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Great to have you on our program.
Thank you so much, Warren.
All right. To the Point, produced this week by Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Sasha Woodruff, Yael Evan Orr, Luke Vanderplug, Devin Schwartz, and Gideon Brower. Our technical director is Mike Newport, and our managing producer is Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.